What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. We are thrilled to be joining you tonight. We are thrilled to be joined by you tonight. And we have an amazing show for you tonight. And, you know, we focus a lot, obviously, on the show and for very good reason on Palestine and foreign policy. Tonight, we are going to be spending the second half of the show talking about Palestine with the inimitable Palestinian journalist, Leila Al-Aryan, who's going to be talking to us about the continuous murderous campaign launched by Israel against the journalists of Gaza, of Palestine, but especially of Gaza. And that, again, will be the second half of the show. She'll also be talking about the complicity of Western media and Western leaders. But during the first half of the show, we're actually going to be talking about some more local issues. And of course, the local issues are also related to foreign policy issues. And that is going to be fun because we haven't done that in a while. And as we'll see, they are pretty interconnected. And before I bring on the trio of guests that we're talking on during the first segment, I'm very excited about, please, just a reminder, please do like the stream, give it a thumbs up. That's a way that you help support the show for free at no cost. Also, if you haven't already, please subscribe. And to do that, you hit subscribe and then you press the bell. If you're not Patreon supporters, please do become Patreon supporters. And you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And this week's Patreon is an amazing chat. It's actually going to be, it's over an hour long chat with Blakely, the great artist, TikTok content creator. And they and I go over, okay, hear me out. We actually make the case for why it's totally appropriate to make fun of Laura Loomer, both inside and out. And we make a very ethical and moral case for why it's fair game to talk about her looks. So that's at Patreon, patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And let's see, I think we're just going to start by bringing on our first trio of guests. And we are going to be joined by someone who's making his Katie Halper Show debut. So things are really, this is a pivotal moment, okay? So we're being joined first by Dean Preston, who is a statewide housing advocate, tenants' rights attorney, public transit enthusiast, and member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He served as the elected representative of District 5 on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and he's best known for his tax the rich and housing justice measures and passing the first ceasefire legislation in a major U.S. city. So welcome, Dean.
Thank you so much, Katie. It's great to be on.
Yes, of course. Another person making their Katie Halper Show debut is Shanti Singh, who is the legislative director at Tenants Together, California's statewide tenant coalition, on the board of the SF Community Land Trust, and is also a longtime DSA member and semi-lapsed tenant organizer. So welcome, Shanti.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And returning to the show, the old standard that we all love, the one and only Kate Willett, who is an award-winning comedian, author, and the co-host of the great podcast Dystopia Now. So welcome back, Kate.
Hello. It's so great to see you guys.
Yeah, it's been a while. So really glad to have you back in the fold, Kate, and also glad to have you guys joining for the first time. You guys should mark down in your diaries this historic date when you're going to get the Katie Halper Show bump. But Dean, I actually want to start off with you because you're someone who has written about abundance. And, you know, people are at a loss right now, or they claim to be at a loss. I think some people genuinely are, like some good faith people don't know what to do about Trump. Then you have bad faith people who I think do know what to do about Trump, but they don't want to do what is needed to do because that would be inconvenient for them and their donors, perhaps. What is abundance, the abundance movement, which is really kind of the unofficial anthem of centrist Democrats? What is the abundant movement and how did you intersect with it while you were in office?
Well, never underestimate the ability of centrist Democrats to kind of repackage the same thing and call it the new shiny object that is the future. And that's abundance. So I've interacted with the abundance movement mostly through it as applied to housing. But it is, of course, broader than that. But it's essentially the idea of creating quote unquote abundant housing by just deregulating housing and letting developers and corporate landlords do whatever they want to create as much housing as possible under the theory that it will then somehow become affordable to working class people because of trickle down economics. So it really is just a form of blaming regulations for the failure to produce for people's needs and trying to popularize the idea that if we just deregulate these industries, that we're going to create an abundance of housing or other services that trickle down to everyone else. It doesn't work. It's never worked. Especially in the realm of housing, where, you know, all the housing that gets created in expensive cities now, unless it's regulated in some way through rent control or through social housing, affordable housing, it's all unaffordable to working class people. So it's really, Ezra Klein has popularized this. He did not start it. There is a movement. There was Abundant SF. There are now abundance organizations. It's a political movement of mostly neoliberal Democrats trying to push a deregulation agenda as if it's going to solve a housing crisis, which it won't.
Right. And Kate, I know that you talk a lot about abundance on your excellent podcast, Dystopia Now. You also talk a lot about it on Twitter. And I know that you focus on how it goes after certain politicians, right? There's this kind of intersection, this abundance tech bro intersection. What do we need to be aware of? Because another reason I want to do this panel is because, of course, a lot of people are talking about the Zohran Mamdani election. And so we're going to see, I think, a lot of things that were applied in San Francisco and in other areas. I think they'll be applied to Zohran. So, Kate, you, I know, actually had Dean on your show. So tell us what you think the connection between actually like Dean and the abundance tech bro movement is.
So I think, you know, in 2024, just to kind of look at the broader picture, Silicon Valley went, for the most part, right. Like the major players went to Trump. And there's a few big tech donors left in the Democratic Party. There's Dustin Moskowitz, who is one of the biggest donors. He has an organization called Open Philanthropy, which is an effective altruist organization. And then there's also Reid Hoffman. And what I think abundance is like basically some of these big tech donors. Patrick Collison is another one, although he donates to Republicans as well. These kind of remaining Democrats in Silicon Valley making a pitch to the rest of Silicon Valley, the right side, and saying like, hey, you know, you can actually do your stuff in the Democratic Party again. We don't have to mess with Trump. And there's also going to be advantages by being in the Democratic Party. Like we can be pro-growth. We can not have tariffs and we can, be even more abundant, I guess, even more deregulated. And, you know, like in a way, okay, yeah, it would be really good if Trump is not the president. We're all in agreement there, I think. But, you know, with the abundance agenda, and especially this pitch to kind of get the tech right back, there's some very creepy things that go with it, which we can maybe get into. But it's also just, I think, very anti-union, very much anti-antitrust. Like Lena Khan was enemy number one for a lot of these guys. And, you know, I think the last thing that we really need right now is the, you know, donor defeat of left populism will be in Trump land forever.
Right. And Shanti, what about you? What has your experience with this movement been, or what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it started. I mean, I was getting started as an organizer the same time they were getting started here in San Francisco. And I just moved here. And I was very much like, it's always been interesting to me because I think I was kind of in the demographic that would have been like a target abundance person, except that I've never, ever been in that. Like, you know, I was new to San Francisco. I was a tech worker at the time. I haven't been in a long time, but you know, like I was kind of coming in, and that's really who they were kind of recruiting from. I think it was more at that time, where in a way that it is not now, a little bit more like tinged with like kind of what was going on in the culture, like in terms of like talking about racial justice, talking about ending residential segregation, things that we all care about and want. It's way more naked now. And I think that is a consequence to what like Kate said about like, you know, the Trump turn in Silicon Valley. They don't really care or talk about that stuff anymore. But that's really how it started. And I think that's how it brought a lot of people in. But at the same time, like they came out the gate, like opposing regulations on Airbnb, supporting or opposing like, you know, organized tenants in communities of color, especially who are fighting for affordable housing instead of market rate housing. They were siding with the market rate housing, opposing those tenants, you know, screaming at people at rallies, things like that. So, you know, I mean, they always kind of had this, flavor, even when they were trying to talk more like progressively, right. They still always had this sort of like tech flavor. They've never really been able to extricate themselves in any, or be really independent of, what Silicon Valley does.
Got it. Now, Dean, can you talk a little bit about your own political trajectory, especially because my show focuses on national politics, and not everyone watching knows about the Board of Supervisors. So tell us what you have kind of dedicated your career to doing, and what lessons should be taken from your own personal journey, political journey.
Yeah, and the two are really connected. I just want to say, you know, when I read Ezra Klein's book on abundance, what really struck me was not that the ideas, I mean, some of the ideas were off, none of it was really new. But what really struck me was the complete absence of talking about the things that have actually worked to make housing more affordable for people, right? So rent control, efforts to decommodify housing. Shanti's been involved with a lot of those around creating land, community land trusts, creating limited equity co-ops, creating social housing. There's all different ways to actually create housing that is regulated and affordable, where people can't have their rent jacked up. People can't just be kicked out because a big corporate landlord decides to kick them out. And you know, as I reflect on it in response, you know, to your question, it's like so much of my work has been all the stuff they won't talk about. You know, they won't talk about the need for rent control, right? Well, we've been so my background is for 20 years before I was in elected office. I was a tenant rights attorney and activist. I founded a statewide tenant rights organization, helped lead the charge to save rent control when there was a landlord ballot measure to abolish rent control across California. And we defeated that. And I went on to do, I wrote the right to counsel legislation and worked with the DSA chapter here in San Francisco to pass one of the strongest right to counsel so that any tenant who's facing eviction gets a free lawyer, kind of like a public defender model that has dramatically reduced evictions. During the pandemic, we led the way in San Francisco. I wrote eviction bans. I also wrote a measure to tax billionaires who are selling property worth $10 million or more. We doubled their tax, and we used that money to pay the back rent of tenants who are now, you know, we banned the evictions, but people still didn't have the money. So we taxed rich developers and corporate landlords to pay those back rents. So my work around right to counsel, strong rent control, taxing the rich to fund rent relief and affordable housing, really has, I hope been impactful. We know when I was in office, that what we can document 20,000 people who were not displaced from their homes because of that, according to a city report. And that's just, I think, the tip of the iceberg. And so we really showed that you can take eviction off the table, And that you can tax the rich to help folks who are struggling to pay their rent. And so not surprisingly, by doing that kind of work, which I've been doing now for 25 years, but 5 years of it in elected office, you earn some enemies, particularly the folks who you're taxing. And so the, you know, the big real estate tycoons have always attacked me from the right. And then the tech, gonna, you know, YIMBY, abundance, all these, whatever name you give it, what has been the driving force in creating a whole bunch of shadowy political organizations in San Francisco with very nice sounding names like right. Neighbor for a Better San Francisco and Together SF. And, you know, these, it's kind of humorous. Every year they come up with new names, but, you know, they've engaged in a pretty extensive smear campaign against me, against other progressives, against folks like Kate, who you have on, who have been vocal online, criticizing this kind of tech swing to the right. So I, you know, I was the first Democratic Socialist elected in San Francisco in 40 years, and tried to govern like I said I was going to govern. And I think we had a pretty big impact during my time in office, but also that earned us, you know, being targeted by a pretty big operation of disinformation and money in San Francisco. And I lost my, I won two elections, I served 5 years, and then lost my reelection bid last year.
Right. And we've had on the show before, for instance, Chesa Boudin, who's mm-hmm. kind of another casualty of astroturfed evil campaigns that give themselves really nice names. So I guess I had two questions for you. One is, do you want to take this opportunity? Because I love debunking things. So if you want to debunk any of the smears or myths that were created about you, and also what advice you have for other politicians or other lawmakers or other organizers, because you're not like your typical politician. You're kind of a housing justice lawyer and an organizer who kind of uses politics. Like, you don't strike me as like a career politician who kind of out of the gates wanted to be a politician. So what advice do you have for other people who are going to be targeted by these people? And what do you want to correct the record on?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to correct the record on. It seems like the longer you're in office, the wilder the allegations get. And I think all of us who are targeted by that are always torn with how much
whether
we
to
want
even to acknowledge it or
whether to acknowledge. And, you know, I think in retrospect, I probably should have much earlier on rebutted a lot of things that just seemed so absurd and were entirely made up. So, you know, one of these opponents who's, you know, seems to be just like full-time trolling me, like created this elaborate website and was claiming I had like blocked, you know, I don't even remember 30,000 or something units of housing. And it was like all made up and just absurd. It was like, you know, I would get like an amendment to a state bill to like protect some tenants, and they would claim anything that didn't get built under that bill was my fault. You know, I mean, it's just like, it was kind of ludicrous saying I had like opposed housing that I'd actually supported. And so I probably underestimated the impact. A Chronicle reporter, the Chronicle is notoriously anti-tenant rights and pro-real estate industry. So they were happy to run with that and platform it. So that was probably the most extensive one. Just, you know, I've really spent a career helping to create affordable housing. So it was really, it just seemed so absurd to be accused of being quote unquote anti-housing and blocking housing. And then the other one was they fabricated entirely this thing that has like gotten legs on that I'm somehow a landlord, which I've never been a landlord my whole life. And so it's been really weird. Again, like you don't know whether to rebut that stuff or not. But I do think it now kind of comes with the territory, you know, and I think in terms of advice and, you know, there's all sorts of folks running at the local level. I mean, Zoran's race is incredibly inspiring and on a lot of the same issues that us Democratic Socialists are running on in other cities. And we see really, I think, an exciting movement of local electeds. And, you know, I would say number one, rebut the disinformation early on, definitely. But the other thing, and this is something I think I learned in office and all of us learned, is I think there's a huge, push of folks coming together to get someone elected. And we see that right now in New York with Zoran. And we see the extent to which the establishment will fight back, even against very popular Democrats. what, you know, my advice were he to ask or anyone else in that situation would be that all that energy that goes into getting him elected is going to be needed. And all that organizing work is going to be needed to implement the agenda. And I think in my own case, we had huge swells of support to get me into office. But what sometimes is missing is like the ongoing organizing project. What tends to happen is working class people who, you know, who vote for leftist candidates like myself, when the election's over, they put a lot aside in terms of time with their families, in terms of their two jobs, their whole, and they go back to that at work. And so what happens is the space in City Hall, the space in terms of media coverage, just gets taken by folks who continue to be plugged in, who are often more well-off, more vocal, right? And a lot of the organizing that propels leftist candidates kind of retreats a little till the next election. And I would just argue that he needs a full court press to overcome Cuomo and Adams and all that machine, right? But the challenge is going to be, like what I found, is you get fought every step of the way. And it's sad, but it's not just about winning the election. Once you're in there, everything we accomplished in office, and I think we have some huge victories, was absolutely the uphill battle against those same forces we were up against in the election, and continuing to organize and make sure that you're working hand in hand with the folks who elect you to office. That will probably be the biggest determinative factor of how much he accomplishes once in office.
Great. Okay, Joran, I hope you're watching this and I hope you took notes. We will keep this up. We won't paywall any of this. Kate, speaking of busting myths, what do you think the greatest kind of housing myths out there are? And I'm talking about, you know, there obviously there's like cynical people who are dishonest, but then you have people who are, again, good faith people, and they just hear a lot of propaganda. And this kind of relates back to what you were just saying, Dean, which is that you can never underestimate the power of money. I mean, because even if something just seems so on its face absurd, all it takes is like repetition, hearing it again and again. And when you have money, you can just plaster the city or plaster the nation, whatever, with ads. So, Kate, what are the biggest myths you think about housing that people need to understand so that they know how these crises about homelessness can be solved?
Well, I think that something that has really, really been pushed hard within the liberal sphere in the past few years is that zoning is the primary reason that we don't have abundant housing. And that if we just change the zoning, we would have abundant housing. They would build so much that our rents would be $1,000 again. And there's actually a very simple reason that that's not going to happen, because change the zoning or not, companies like developers build when the rents are going up. That's how they get investors who, you know, basically like they need to be receiving, you know, not just a good return on their money, but it has to be a better return than less risky investments. So you'll never have a situation where the rents are falling and falling and developers, you know, are just addicted to building and they can get their financing, unless you did it with social housing. The government, the state could actually build and build even while the rents are falling. So I guess the biggest myth is, yeah, that like there's a one simple trick to abundance. Like, no, we actually need a lot of non-market housing to get enough supply that the rents would actually drop meaningfully.
Mm-hmm. And Shanti, what do you have to add to that as someone who's done housing organizing? Myths about either housing or I guess just in general myths, like abundance myths or neoliberal myths. Because again, it's really frustrating when you see people get seduced by arguments who are I think are winnable people. And if they just heard the right, like heard the truth, they would be in our camp.
Yeah, I think Kate and Dean covered the biggest one, where it's just like, you know, it's that the market's just ready to build and we just need to let them. That's not true. And then you don't need to, if you want to have a real conversation with someone who doesn't agree with you about that, don't talk to an abundance person, talk to an actual developer. They'll tell you that stuff straight up. I need rents to go up 20% in the Bay Area is actually something that a housing economist like a Berkeley or whatever, who's been part of their kind of real estate think tank. Literally, he just said that out loud, right? But like that, just listen to them. Listen to what they have to say, because they don't propagandize about that stuff. But, you know, I mean, I think it goes back to something that I've really been reflecting on, which is that, you know, our narrative is more popular. And you can see that with Zoran Mamdani's candidacy, right? He said, freeze the rent, right? That was one of his leading messages. It's simple. It's understandable. I mean, you know, I think last year, Redfin, which is like a real estate firm, right? It's the website you go to look at home listings. They did a survey and they're not pro rent control people at all. And they found that 4 out of 5 Americans, not Democrats, not Republicans, Americans support restricting how much rent can go up every year in some form or another, right? 4 out of 5, 80%. So when people talk about 80-20 issues like rent control, things like that, that are counter to the abundance narrative, they're more popular with people than abundance is. Abundance is primarily like, it's not a public persuasion campaign. It's an elite persuasion campaign. And insofar as it's successful, it's because it appeals to elites. But that being said, though, yeah, I mean, I think the most well-meaning people who support abundance, but like think that they can kind of be a left thing, I don't agree with them. But it really is about just continuing to emphasize things like rent control and social housing that they claim they want, because eventually they're going to find out that the rest of the abundance folks don't really support those things at all. And in fact, actually actively work to oppose and undermine them every day.
Right. And Shanti, another thing I wanted to ask you about tell us about YIMBYs.
Oh, man. What about them?
How much time do you have?
Yeah, how much time do you have? No, I'll try to keep it quick. I mean, it is kind of going back to, I think, insofar as like there are people out there who really like believe in it. It's they're looking at those people, the good faith argument is they're looking at the legitimate problems that are caused by exclusionary people, right? Who sometimes are their own parents. I often say YIMBYs are fighting their own parents, sometimes literally so. But, you know, it's like, it's basically, you know, affluent people who want to block affordable housing.
And it stands for, just so people don't, it stands for instead of not in my backyard, right? Which is NIMBY.
It's yes in my backyard. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, but unfortunately, you know, they focused on this sort of deregulatory side of things. And, you know, instead of actually promoting like, you know, yes to social housing, yes to rent control, et cetera, things like that. You know, they took an exclusively market focus, and the really tough thing that I think it's sometimes really hard for socialists and progressives to deal with is that they've created this binary, right? That you're either a YIMBY or a NIMBY. And like, we have to reject that binary. It's a false binary, right? That you just don't want to build anything for anybody and you want to shut the door behind you, or you're a market fundamentalist and you can't be anything else. So that's really where they have kind of, they've kind of branded themselves to like the main thing that they've really done is to try to create that binary in the discourse. And it's sometimes people struggle, especially political candidates, et cetera. Like, how do I deal with that? Like, you know, to not want to be in either of those buckets.
Okay. That sounds, I like that. Reject the binary. Okay,
I just wanted to add one thing as it pertains to Zoran. So Zoran, I think, had a very interesting approach to the problem that Shanti is describing, which is like Zoran, he kind of appropriated their rhetoric, you know, like, yes, let's do abundance. So, you know, it was releasing videos about like certain permits that we could get rid of and stuff. And a lot of the ideas that he's proposing, you know, like removing large fees for small businesses, like they are good ideas. I'm not against any of them on the merits, you know, but I think one thing that he was able to do is like, he hasn't won over the hardcore, like neoliberal abundance think tanks or whatever, but like the regular people that are just hearing these ideas and they're like, oh yeah, yeah. Like, you know, regulations are why stuff is expensive. Like he's addressing like the popular mentality or whatever. I do wonder, you know, like a lot of these abundance people, once he started winning, like even the, you know, abundance influencers and abundance think tanks, like they started praising him and they're like, oh, actually, this represents us too, because their neoliberal thing is like so, so unpopular. But I do think that if Zoran really does what he says he's going to do, freeze the rent, you know, builds a lot of social housing, and I think that he will make good on his promises, like these people are going to turn on him in an instant. Real estate is not going to be on the side of a democratic socialist.
Right. Right. That's it. Yeah. Good advice. So wanted to ask you guys, shifting gears a little bit, you know, someone who's capturing a lot of hearts and minds, potentially, or at least the hearts and minds of certain people, certain centrists, I guess I would say, is Governor Gavin Newsom. A lot of people want this guy to run for president. So I actually wanted to just show a post that he did when he took to the Twitters. And he posted, this is from June, he posted the following. Let's take a look. "I just enacted the most game-changing housing reforms in recent California history. We're urgently embracing an abundance agenda by tearing down the barriers that have delayed new affordable housing and infrastructure for decades. Let's get building, California." So what are your thoughts on this game-changing?
It's not. Sorry, I know I should have volunteered who wants to go first, and I just volunteered myself.
It's okay, I understand, yeah.
Gavin Newsom has, he made a big promise when he became governor. He was going to build like 3.5 million units of housing, and so this X amount was going to be affordable. He's done none of that. And if anything, he has actually cut housing programs and homelessness programs, and gone around. Of course, people have seen the pictures of him, cleaning up, stealing belongings from homeless people, which for a guy who was literally raised by the Getty family is just appalling. But no, he slashed the budget. He can talk about affordable housing reforms all as much as he wants, but we're not going to get affordable housing if we don't get public investment. And that is not something that Gavin Newsom supports. He's an opportunist, right? Right now, abundance is like the hot, elite buzzword in the Democratic Party. So he's latching onto that. That's all he does. If it were fashionable to like block housing or do this or whatever, none of his positions are his own, right? He would go that way too. So it's none of it's like remotely sincere, but that's him. That's what he's always been like.
Yeah. And he is doing in that tweet and has been doing in office the same thing that Klein does when he talks about abundance in his book, and the same thing the YIMBY and abundance movement does. And that is to strip out like any actual class analysis and any actual nuance of who this abundance is for. So just to give you an example, like in San Francisco, we have these cycles every 8 years mandated by the state, and you have targets of how much to produce. We've overproduced luxury housing, like 150% of our goal. We have an abundance of luxury housing. It's sitting empty. We have 40,000 or more empty units just sitting there empty, right? We have underproduced. We only hit 50% of our goal for affordable housing, right? Gavin Newsom's on an even worse track. We have to be producing 100,000 units of affordable housing every year for the next 10 years, right? I'm not talking market rate stuff that trickles down. I'm talking about stuff that when you build it, anyone can move into it and afford it, right? He's not even hitting 20% of his goals, and he's actually giving less each year, right? So what they do is they obscure all the differences between who are you building for,
right?
And they would say we need to deregulate. I mean, if he was up there streamlining and deregulating affordable housing and doing massive investments in social housing, nobody would be opposing that. Right. Like the reason there's opposition is because he's making all these changes which incentivize gentrification and displacement from expensive cities. And he's not investing in the things that will help people in those cities remain there. And like the clearest example, Katie, that I can point to of this, right, is every one of these things that he's saying is this big transformative housing thing. At best, he like rezones something, like Kate said, maybe one day the market, the rents go up enough that it makes sense for them to build it. So maybe 10 years from now, something he is doing in terms of some zoning or streamlining thing happening right now might result, under his theory, in a new unit 5-10 years later. And maybe there's trickle down if he's right, right? Like that's their whole theory. On the other hand, here's what he's not doing. There's a state law that bars strong rent control. He could repeal that immediately, and cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Oakland, San Jose could just lower the rent. Mm. And nobody wants to talk about that. Like if you want to lower the rent, the idea is it's like streamlining, maybe something gets built 10 years, something like that. That's even under their own theory, it doesn't solve an urgent problem. We have 1 in 4 people who is homeless in the United States of America is homeless in California. It is like red alert, right? Like the state needs to be funneling billions of dollars more into affordable housing, right? And instead, this guy's doing photo ops, like Shanti said, you know, at sweeps, you know, throwing away homeless people's things. He's decreasing state investments. And then he's doing these big investments of his giveaways to developers so that they can build stuff no one can afford, you know? And it really is. So it's great. He's found a word with abundance that probably pulls well.
Right.
You know, those of us who actually like work with low income and working class people, none of what he's doing really helps anyone.
Right.
I just wanted to add super quick, like California is the richest subnational jurisdiction on the planet. We spend 1% of our budget on all housing and homelessness programs combined. And Gavin Newsom's message the last since COVID began basically has been we're spending too much money while 6% of it goes to prison. So that's Gavin Newsom for you.
Yeah. And he's pretty punitive, right? When it comes to, you're talking about these sweeps, but can you guys explain what these sweeps are?
Yeah. You know, there was a Supreme Court case, Grants Pass versus Johnson, I think, or Johnson v. Grants Pass, that basically now means that homeless people who have no shelter, nowhere to go, can have their belongings confiscated, can be brutalized, et cetera. Gavin Newsom and San Francisco Abundance Democrats actually filed amicus briefs in support of the Trump Supreme Court.
Protested in the street. Not to interrupt you, but they went out there with their little signs to support Grants Pass.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's abundance.
Pretty Trumpian.
That's abundance.
I thought these guys were the anti-Trumps.
Yeah, yeah. They love building housing, except for actually people who actually need homes the most.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, they actively supported that Supreme Court decision. They welcomed it when it passed. They sided with Donald Trump Supreme Court. They should never, ever be able to live that down. But that's exactly, that's Gavin Newsom. That's Abundance Democrats here in California.
Shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to bring something up that is not at all surprising. I mean, it's really disturbing, but the DNC just chose not to advance two measures about the genocide in Gaza. Obviously, they didn't call it the genocide, but there were two versions of this. One was the quote unquote progressive version, which was brought forward from a younger and newer member, Allison Minerly, and called for the party to endorse a motion to bring an arms embargo against Israel and to suspend military aid. And the other one was brought forward by the more seasoned, obviously, and more centrist DNC chair, Ken Martin. And that called for unrestricted humanitarian aid and a two-state solution. So even though Martin's motion originally passed, he later withdrew it, citing the need for more discussion, something that other members agreed with. So I don't know what you need to have more discussion over in the middle of a genocide, but what is your response to this move by the DNC? And also, what are your thoughts on what the Democrats can and should do about what's happening in Gaza? Dean or Sean, I'll throw this to Dean because I know you actually worked on a resolution.
Yeah, sure.
And then we'll go to you, Shanti, okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's just another completely cowardly move by, you know, by Democratic Party and by so many Democratic leaders of refusing to speak out. I mean, I don't know how one can be witnessing what we've all witnessed for almost 2 years now, and not support cutting off American funding that's killing and starving people. I mean, it's absolutely, if you have any, you know, any care for human rights to be obstructing these kind of resolutions and statements is really unconscionable. I mean, my background in this is like, I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor. I believe and have always believed never again means never again. And I've been very proud actually of a lot of fellow Jews and other organizers who have been like speaking out and from the start. And we actually worked with both Jewish groups and Arab groups here in San Francisco and introduced the ceasefire resolution back in what seems like ages ago, back in December 2023, and became the biggest city and first major city to pass a ceasefire resolution. But it was quite a process. And the disconnect at that time between the various lobbyists, interest groups, and I'm talking across the political spectrum, the disconnect between the political insiders and the people of San Francisco was just so striking. I mean, we had everyone from, I had long people I had organized with on leftist stuff in San Francisco for decades, calling me the night before introducing that resolution, demanding that we don't introduce it, right? Like everyone across the board. And, That's in terms of the organized groups, right? But then when I introduced the ceasefire resolution, we had more turnout from San Francisco residents to come in support of that resolution than anything I saw, like it exponentially more people than anything I introduced. Eviction bans, like popular legislation, all the things we did, nothing even compared. We had thousands of people, lines wrapped around City Hall to come in and speak in support. And, you know, and so it's just, we saw that then, we're seeing it now with the Democratic Party. You have these, you know, ostensible leaders who will not listen to the overwhelming majority of their party, who are not taking some radical position. They're literally saying, you know, because of our inaction, because of continuing to fund this, like journalists are being killed, children are starving, hospitals are being bombed, and enough, right? And people have been saying it. And finally, some folks are coming around who have been attacking all the organizers for years. And it's like, great to see you, but it's like a little late, you know, but I guess better late than never. But to continue to obstruct those things now, with having seen what has occurred for nearly 2 years, like I don't know what you're doing in a position of power and how you sleep at night if you're torpedoing resolutions that try to cut off funding for the Israeli regime right now.
Yeah. And there are California Democrats who are actively doing harm. There is a bill in the legislature right now that's very dangerous. It's Assembly Bill 715. It would basically make it like impossible to criticize say anything critical of Israel in an educational setting, right? In K-12 public schools, right? They're attacking public education. They're attacking the integrity of public education. And these are Democrats doing this, including my state senator and deans. You know, they're not just like complicit. They're actively trying to make it harder where anything, you can be fired if you are a teacher and you say anything, including things that Israeli prime ministers have said about apartheid, or, you know, anything that undermines Israel's right to exist. It's not just purely limited to anti-Semitism. It's basically saying anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Right,
which is in itself anti-Semitic, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's trying to make that state law in our school system. They are advancing this bill right now, right? So if you're in California, I call your legislator and tell them to oppose this. It's awful. And so they're actively making it worse. And it just goes back to, like, you know, they are part of Trump's assault on democracy, whether they want to admit it to themselves or not. Right. And it's like what Ta-Nehisi Coates said, right? Like he said, like, if you can't oppose a genocide, why would I trust you to protect democracy? They have paved the road for Trump to crack down on universities and education, et cetera. It's Democrats who have done that and continue to do that. So
if I can just add one quick thing here, I think to tie these two parts of the conversation together, I'm looking at the co-authors of bill that Shanti mentioned. And it appears that Scott Wiener is one of the co-authors. He was the person standing next to Gavin Newsom in that picture. And I think one of the functions that we see from abundance from like these ruling class Democrats is there's just basically like no way to get people, like the majority of Democratic voters, to be into, like, you know, super pro sending Israel politics right now. And so, you know, the way that they're getting people in, like, is through this abundance stuff. Like Richie Torres, for example, was one of the first people to embrace it. And, you know, I'm just seeing, like, you know, Reid Hoffman is backing this like new 26-year-old candidate in New York. I think his name's like Liam something, where like he's, you know, he's pretty pro-Israel. And I think that they're just kind of like, they think that they can like trick us with like zoning into supporting a genocide, which is, it's really so dumb. I can't believe that they think it's going to work, but that's the plan.
Well, we're about to wrap. I actually wanted to, as the last thing I wanted to show is a video of you, Dean, introducing the ceasefire resolution. So let's take a look at that, and then I'll ask you guys for your final thoughts.
I'm introducing a resolution calling for a sustained ceasefire in Gaza. Humanitarian aid and the release of all hostages, and condemning anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anti-Palestinian hate. I have heard from thousands of San Franciscans experiencing severe pain and trauma. Palestinians here in our city feel particularly unseen, unheard by this country's leaders who continue to unconditionally back the destruction of Gaza and the killing of thousands of Palestinians, including thousands of children, even while the vast majority of the American public wants a ceasefire. Just this morning, I heard from a Palestinian American friend. From a Palestinian American friend here in San Francisco who informed me, and I quote, 7 more members of my family have been killed overnight. Excuse me. 7 more members of my family have been killed overnight and this morning. At least 100 have already been killed since October 7th. Close quote.
Yeah, that was early on, right? This was not something that you just jumped on the bandwagon today. I'm just curious, can you just talk a little bit about your parents' experience in the Holocaust and how that made you believe in never again means never again for anyone?
Sure. My dad and my grandparents were among the last folks to, they're from Stuttgart, Germany, and they were among the last folks to actually to get out. My dad's grandmother, my great grandmother was killed in a concentration camp. Through my family's experience, grew up very aware of their experience of the horrors of how genocide occurs, of the dehumanization of others, the things that folks in Germany at the time assumed could never happen to them. My father went to a small elementary school in Stuttgart that had 40 kids in his class. Only 4 survived and got out. For me professionally and personally, it was always, I'd done a lot of work over the years focused on preventing official abuse, defending human rights. When I was in law school, I went and worked at the International Criminal Tribunal of the former Yugoslavia, investigating and helping to prosecute perpetrators of genocide in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda. I think many of us have always wondered what we would do if we were around in a time when something like that was occurring and when our country was involved. We all have the answer to what would we have been doing in 1930s Germany by what are we doing right now to resist Trump and what are we doing right now to stop the genocide in Gaza. So I was very moved by the stories. I talked in that about the one Palestinian American person friend who had texted me about losing 100 family members. That was right before the vote. Just unfathomable. I mean, just thinking of the pain of constituents and of family members when you lose one family member and just trying to imagine what that's like for these bombs to just take out apartment buildings and take out 100 of your family members. And I represented many communities in District 5. One of them is the Tenderloin neighborhood, which actually has a big Arab immigrant community there. And I had spoken with a lot of folks about their experience. And so we moved forward, in December. It didn't seem early. I mean, now it seems like that was early. I will tell you, at that time, it felt like it had been going on for 2 months and nothing had happened. There were street protests, but nothing official from the city. So we moved forward with that resolution, ended up passing it. What was such a simple and was intentionally written not to litigate all of the geopolitical history of the region, but simply to say, we need a ceasefire, stop this killing, get massive humanitarian aid. And like, that's it, right? I was perhaps naive at the time in thinking I had written something that was so basic for anyone who cares about human rights and cares about others that no one could possibly oppose it. And I introduced it. The local Jewish community relations group came out on the attack, said I was conspiring with anti-Semites to introduce a hate resolution. I had members of the Board of Supervisors. I'll never forget one who I went to ask for his support, who said, well, I'm on Team Israel. I'm not getting off that train. I said, no matter what you see, I'm not there, no matter what I see. And so just, you know, that mentality of people who I've known for so long, who fought with me side by side for human rights in our city and our nation, just having this blind spot and tolerating a genocide in Gaza was eye-opening in bad ways, but also really inspiring to see the community that came together here and then in other cities to speak out and continues, no matter how much they're repressed and told to shut up, how people are still speaking out. So, hope for a better future, but it's certainly not been, the last couple of years, I think for so many of us, it's just been appalling to see what this country has funded and supported.
Yeah, it's so disgusting. I wanted to bring on the next guest because I know I'm gonna wrap with you guys, but I do want to bring on the next guest because I believe she had a message that she wrote to you, Dean. This is the amazing Leila Al-Aryan, who is a journalist with Fault Lines of AJ Al Jazeera English, and really fearless, outspoken activist and extremely principled journalist. So I'm going to bring on Leila, and then for a final round of questions, and then you guys will say goodbye and we'll talk more with Leila. So hi, Leila. Thanks for joining.
Hi, Katie. Thank you so much for having me. And I just wanted to thank you, Dean, for your beautiful words. I hadn't seen that video before. And I think something I've been thinking a lot about as we're, it's getting to be 2 years into this genocide, and it's just crazy to think that it's gone on for this long. But and this may sound maybe simplistic to some people, but I truly believe this in my heart. There's people who see the humanity of Palestinians, and there's people who simply don't. And your tears, your emotion, your fight for this resolution is clear indication that you do see the humanity of Palestinians. And it just, I think I wish that there were more people like you and like Shanti and like Cade and Katie and everybody on this panel. So
thank you, Leila.
Well, yeah. And I'm so grateful to journalists like you. And also, I mean, we'll talk about this more, but I'm so sorry about what has happened to your family. And also I'm really grateful for journalists like you, for not just the journalism you do, but the way that you are so fearless and uncompromising in the way you rightly condemn the silence of other journalists as their colleagues are being slaughtered. I mean, it's despicable. So, and I can't imagine what it's like for you as a journalist who has family in Palestine, who comes from a Palestinian family. Like, I can't imagine.
Thank you, Katie.
So, yeah, of course. And everyone should watch all of Leila's documentaries also that are amazing. Any final words, Shanti, Kate, or Dean?
I'm really looking forward to checking out your documentaries, Leila. It's great to meet you. And yeah, I think it was good to be reminded when watching Dean's speech that, like, you know, like the place that people are in now is different, and more Americans are standing up, and it's too little and it's too late, but like so many minds have changed since then. And hopefully it'll become obvious to our lawmakers at some point that they won't keep their seats if they don't get where we are, you know?
Yeah. I just to add to that, I think, Palestine like touches every issue, even as like a housing person, like I think about it every day, but it's because it's actually like, it is the fundamental test of American democracy today. I believe that firmly. It's supporting Palestinians. So.
And I would just add, on so many of the issues we've been talking about, they really are that test just around whether, as Layla said, whether people dehumanize other people or actually value them. And, you know, we were talking earlier about approaches to homelessness in California. And there are absolutely two camps at this point. There are people who blame homeless people for being homeless and think that the solution is law enforcement. And that Gavin Newsom is one of them, that the solution is to send the police out. That's what the mayor of San Francisco is doing. That's what a lot of neoliberal and certainly Republican, neoliberal Democrats and Republicans push for those kind of solutions. And then there are other people who recognize the humanity and know that most of the country is one paycheck away from homelessness, and that, people are, there's complex circumstances of why people are homeless. And if you want to end homelessness, you need to house people. Right. And get care for people who need care. And at some level, it is that simple. And what we see with so much now, and certainly with the abundance movement, is really an attempt not to center the needs of those who are most marginalized, who need help the most, right? And often to either criminalize their existence or be okay with atrocities being committed against them. And that does really apply across the board on so many issues. And when we talk about housing, we should talk about the tragedy of people sleeping on the street, right? And we should solve that by building the kind of housing that's going to get people off the street, not more luxury condos. And same discussion around healthcare, and the same discussion, frankly, around a lot of groups like trans folks and others who are getting targeted, and who are the most marginalized, and who I think that a lot of neoliberal Democrats, certainly Gavin Newsom, have decided they're going to build their careers on punching down on those who are struggling in this society. So I think, just kudos to all the folks who are organizing, to all the local electeds who are kind of pushing the envelope, because I think people are seeing through these kind of fake politicians more and more.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much, and definitely come back on the show. Loved having you guys.
Thanks
for your time.
You guys. Bye.
Bye.
Layla, welcome. This is actually the first time you've done a live. I've interviewed you before about your amazing documentaries. And I feel like one of the signs, by the way, that a documentary is good is that you feel like enriched. I know it sounds weird, but like it portrays something so horrific, but you feel so much better, not better emotionally, but it is just, when you watch one of your films, it gives you like, I mean, I just to be candid, it's like I feel the simultaneous utter hopelessness and despair, and then a little bit of hope, just knowing that there are people out there who are making stuff about this and capturing it. So I don't know what it's like for you as someone who, I mean, it must be, I imagine it's excruciating to work on these projects. And I guess I didn't do a good, I just jumped into this, but can you talk about some of your most recent documentaries that you've made?
Sure. Thank you, Katie, so much for having me on and for being such a crucial voice during this horrific time. So I'm the executive producer of a documentary show on Al Jazeera English called Fault Lines. It's actually Al Jazeera English's flagship investigative documentary show. It's based in Washington, D.C., and we've made 4 films on the genocide in Gaza. The first one we made was called The Night Won't End. It's actually a feature-length film investigating civilian killings by the Israeli military in Gaza. We focus primarily on the case of 3 families who experienced just utter horror, loss of family members in airstrikes and executions, as well as the case of Hind Rajab, the 5-year-old girl who was in her car when her entire family was executed. And then she later was killed along with the rescue workers sent to get her. So we actually have a separate episode about that film. Feel free to check it out. But we also, it's a team effort, of course. I work with wonderfully talented colleagues. We made a film called Starving Gaza, actually, that was released a year ago about the starvation of Gaza. We're working on a follow-up about the Gaza, so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. We released a film called Kids Under Fire about the sniping of children in Gaza. We did one called All That Remains about a 13-year-old girl who came to the U.S. for treatment after losing her legs. So we're really trying to cover every major story we can in long form and investigative you know, sort of documentary form so that people can really bear witness, which is the very least we can all do.
Right. And I mean, what are your thoughts on, we talked about this last week, but your thoughts on the State Department's decision to pause these visas, given that you've worked on films, on a documentary about someone coming to the States for medical treatment. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? And are you ever like, are you over being surprised? Is there anything that Israel does that actually surprises you, or is that impossible now?
This is a conversation I have a lot with friends and colleagues. I mean, I would say my biggest fear is actually becoming numb to these atrocities and having them just be normalized. So I've been working so hard over the last almost 2 years to fight against that and to experience that emotion, experience the grief, the shock, the horror, the disappointment, the outrage. There's a lot of rage, which is very well placed. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, outrageous, you know, utter dehumanization of Palestinian children to stop a group of children. Let's back up a little bit. First of all, the person who supposedly uncovered the fact that children from Gaza were coming to the United States for medical treatment was Laura Loomer, a far-right, unhinged, Islamophobe activist. I don't know what you want to call it. The problem
and
is...
And self-proclaimed, she calls herself a proud Islamophobe.
Oh yeah, she calls herself a proud. And then the mainstream media, when you look at coverage of her, call her an anti-Muslim activist. Imagine any scenario in which someone would be described as an anti-Jewish activist or an anti-Christian.
Totally.
I mean, never. But it shows you the normalization of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim hate and bigotry. But Laura Loomer is, you know, as loony as you can get. And she tweeted
Sorry, really quick. I didn't think of that until you just brought that up. But like, obviously you and I and everyone watching knows that the term anti-Semite is weaponized and it often means anti-Zionist. But like, someone who's a proud anti-Semite, or imagine them introducing someone who called themselves a proud anti-Semite being like anti-Semitic activists. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, she has Trump's ear. She's powerful. She goes to the White House and demands that people be fired. And even the media coverage of her, I find, is very sanitized and downplayed as far as her bigotry. I mean, the New York Times podcast, The Daily, actually had a whole episode looking at who is Laura Loomer, this far-right activist with Trump's ear. Never once do they mention Israel. Israel is what animates Laura Loomer. She's from Florida. She's never hidden that fact. And not a mention of Israel. So Laura Loomer tweets, she acts like it's an investigation. I mean, these organizations, there's two main organizations that bring children, Palestinian children, to the U.S. for medical treatment. One is called HEAL. One is called the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. They bring these children, and I should mention a tiny number of children. I mean, Israel has created the largest cohort of pediatric amputees per capita in modern history. No other conflict even comes close. And a very small number of those pediatric amputees are coming for treatment. There's other cases that they bring as well, like, for example, famine and malnutrition cases. But it's really, you're talking about a tiny number. And these organizations put these videos of these airport arrivals when the children come in and they're celebrated and people warmly greet them online. They have nothing to hide. All of this is done above board. And but she acted like it was some big investigation. And apparently by the next day, the New York Times reported she actually got through to Marco Rubio. So this is someone who has a direct line to the Secretary of State demanding that he rescind those visas. And the State Department very quickly, I believe it was a Saturday, where they tweeted that they would stop these visas. I mean, imagine working on a weekend to rescind visas to child amputees. And it was our bonds and our taxpayer money as Americans that actually led to these amputations and these injuries. It's just, it's beyond words.
It really is. Yeah, it's absolutely repulsive. And another thing that's beyond words, I think, is what Israel continues to do to journalists. You know, it seems like every show this comes up, and that's because like every show, there's another outrageous action of genocidal criminality and targeting. And so just this weekend, at least 21 people, including 5 journalists who were killed, over 50 injured in a double tap strike on Nasser Hospital, What are your thoughts on this as a journalist yourself and on Israel's kind of intentional elimination and targeting of journalists in Gaza?
It's horrifying. I mean, every single time a journalist is killed, and I should start out by saying Israel is the leading killer of journalists in the world in modern history. So a Brown University study, a very important study, came out showing, this isn't even that recent, it was several months ago that it came out, so which shows you the scale of these atrocities, showed that Israel has killed more journalists in Gaza than in World War, the U.S. Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korea War, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yugoslavia combined. That is how many journalists Israel has killed in Gaza. You're talking about, if you're looking at the Committee to Protect Journalists, just under 200. If you're looking at higher numbers, which are likely the more accurate ones coming out of Gaza, you're talking about a minimum of 240 journalists. This is a staggering number, and it's systematic, and it's targeted, and it's deliberate. They have threatened many of these journalists for months before killing them. They have smeared them in death and in life sometimes. And they have lied about why they've killed them. I don't even know where to begin except to say that sometimes when you hear about the killing of a journalist, you think, might this be the time that people are finally going to demand that this stop? We thought maybe it was the killing of our colleague Ismail Al-Ghul in July of 2024, when Israel hit him so hard that he actually was beheaded and his own colleagues saw his head separated from his body. Maybe it was the killing of 19-year-old Hassan Hamad in his home. Hassan was in his own room uploading material. He worked for a production company called Media Town, which we actually partner with on all of our films at Fault Lines, an incredible Palestinian Gaza-based production company. Hassan was targeted with a drone in his own home, 19 years old. And by the time his colleagues found his body, they could only collect some parts and put them in a small bag. That's how shredded his body was. Or maybe it was the killing of Anas al-Sharif, Al Jazeera's most prominent journalist, on August 10th. He was the most famous face in Gaza. And if Israel can get away with killing him, they can really get away with killing any journalist. Again, they smeared him as a Hamas operative, which is a patent lie. It's absolutely untrue. And of course, that didn't stop them, because yesterday they killed five more journalists. And actually, after that attack you talked about, the double tap strike at Nasser Hospital, they also killed another journalist in his tent. So this is just unending. It's horrific. It's outrageous. And for the most part, I see silence from the media industry in the West. Not just silence. Sometimes I see an outright justification of these killings. And talk about adding insult to injury. When a state like Israel can get away with killing the highest number of journalists ever killed in any one place in modern history, that puts a target on the back of every single journalist anywhere in the world. It makes all journalists unsafe. And rather than give these Palestinian journalists their solidarity, their support, rather than demand that Israel stop killing them, rather than demand that Israel be punished and sanctioned for these killings, sometimes we see Western journalists actually amplifying Israeli lies and justifications for these killings.
I actually, yeah, it is repulsive. And I just can't even imagine, because I feel so angry about this and I'm not a Palestinian journalist. And so it must just be like 17,000 times more painful for you. So I just, and also I know you have family and you have children, and I just can't imagine like how you stay not, I mean, I don't know, like, I don't know how you go on. It's so hard. And so I guess I'm just saying I really appreciate that you, despite this, or maybe because of it, like, you know, because of that, maybe that is, you keep on keeping on, because how can you not, right? Like, how can you not do everything you can to expose what's happening? But I really do just, I'm so grateful to people like you. So, you know, we will get into the like despicable media complicity on this, because again, it is such an infuriating, not travesty. It's an outrage that there is not more solidarity. But I do also want to show a very disturbing clip, but I think it's really relevant and we should make sure that people do see what's happening here. This is chief commentator Zvi Yehgzavel from Channel I-24 in Israel. Here's what he had to say about Gaza-based journalists. He said this live on air. Let's take a listen. And if Israel has already decided to eliminate the journalists, then better late than never. Just to be clear, these are journalists who hide in hospitals, who set up war rooms there, who broadcast to the world a completely distorted picture, still serving Hamas's interests. You could say that the spearhead of Hamas's military wing are those Nukba journalists. Therefore, Israel did well to eliminate them. In my view, it was too late, and there are still many, many more who continue to cause image and perceptional damage in a battle that, unfortunately, we are not particularly excelling in. I like that idea that it's like they're just bad at PR. The problem isn't that they're killing, murdering children, leading in child amputations, as you know from your work. No, it's just a question of ER and damage control. But what are your thoughts? I mean, about this insane statement that, again, you'd think that people would say this behind closed doors, but they actually broadcast it.
It's heinous. I mean, it's a heinous, outrageous smear. And there's a reason that after the Holocaust, people who were working in media were prosecuted for incitement to genocide and violence. There's a reason that even in, you know, the Rwanda genocide, journalists were also put on trial. This is just an example of that, and of that dehumanization, the smears, the lies that are used to fuel Israel's campaign of violence, that it's unleashed its campaign of terror for nearly 2 years in Gaza. This doesn't happen in a vacuum. You have so many different organs and elements of the state, including, unfortunately, journalists, so-called journalists in Israel, who are inciting violence and inciting violence against fellow journalists. It's disgusting. It's disappointing. But at the same time, it's a reflection of the wider kind of genocidal attitude pervade Israel. When you look at opinion polls, a vast majority of Israelis actually support
exactly
Gaza.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's like in some cases, you know, you look, I as a U.S. citizen, I always appreciate that people are able to distinguish between governments and societies. But honestly, like I had someone on the show who's both a friend and a guest, and he's one of the subjects in this documentary I'm making about Holocaust survivors and their descendants who are speaking out against genocide. He's the son of Holocaust survivors. His parents weighed like 70 pounds when their camps were liberated. And he's like, I mean, distraught constantly because he sees images of kids in Gaza who look like child versions of his parents in their camps. And he says that this is the most democratic genocide in history because of the level of support for it. And as you just pointed out, you know, let's see, there's I think that polling from August, earlier of August, shows that 76% of Israeli Jews think there are no innocents in Gaza. I mean, I don't know what to say about that, except there's a sickness there. What do you think is stopping journalists here from speaking out? Because, I mean, I think that if this were in any other country, there would be moments of silence. There would be calls from our government. You know, there would be calls like extremely strong condemnations. And it's obviously not strong enough because you just had this person announcing that there should and will be more of these murderous attacks.
You've seen a very organized campaign to actually delegitimize Palestinian journalists, to paint them as biased, as unprofessional, as Hamas, you know, even as fighters. And they don't even need evidence provided by the Israeli military. Unfortunately, Israel's word is enough, even though Israel has repeatedly lied to journalists. I mean, well before October 7th, 2023, we have ample examples of Israel lying to journalists time and again, whether it was in 2021 when they told a group of journalists that they were going to go into Gaza with ground troops. And then in reality, they admitted that they actually lied and that they wanted Hamas fighters to go underground and they wanted to bomb them in their tunnels. They admitted, they said, yeah, we used the media. Ha ha, isn't that great? Or when they killed my Al Jazeera colleague, Shirin Abu Akla, in 2022 and repeatedly lied about that and only were forced to admit that they were the ones who killed her after
many investigations. Shireen's killing was the most investigated killing of any Palestinian in history. So many different news organizations actually looked into it. My own team at Fault Lines, but also CNN and New York Times and Washington Post and United Nations and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, all everything you can imagine, Beit Salem, everybody investigated her killing. And it was only after all those investigations was Israel finally, you know, they with their back to the wall, able to admit that it was actually one of their soldiers. But even then, there was no accountability. There was nothing. So despite its very long track record of outright lying to and misleading journalists, journalists still believe them. And let me give you the latest outrageous example. And unfortunately, there is no shortage of examples. Every single day, there are examples of Western legacy media taking what the Israeli military says, and even though it makes no sense, no logical sense, and publishing it without any question, without actually reporting out those claims. Just today, the Israeli military and government came out and said that when they attacked Nasser Hospital Complex, it was because of a Hamas camera. It was a Hamas camera that was on the roof that they were actually trying to get. Now, why does that not make sense? Well, first of all, what is a Hamas camera? Second of all, it was verified that that's actually the Reuters live stream position. The Reuters and AP live stream position is what they attacked. So first of all, we know that they attacked the Reuters and live stream position. And secondly, let's say it was true and it was a Hamas camera. Again, so many logical problems with that. Number one, why is it two strikes? If you're only going after the camera, why do you then go and strike again and kill that group of journalists and the rescue workers that came to check on the first journalist who was attacked? Number two, if you're saying that your intelligence is so good and you know exactly that this is a Hamas camera and you're going after the Hamas camera, wouldn't your intelligence also show a group of journalists and a group of rescue workers that you then went on to attack? It makes no sense. They don't actually report out the claims that Israel makes. Instead, what does Reuters do? Again, an AP, it is their live position. They put in the headline, Israel says they were attacking a Hamas camera. This is stenography. This is not journalism. It is embarrassing. It is unprofessional. And it aids and abets genocide when they're constantly regurgitating what a state that's plausibly accused of committing genocide says to justify its ongoing mass killing campaign.
It is beyond disgusting. And the double tap thing, which is like such a disgusting, it's almost like a casual like way of describing it, a double tap thing. You're just like killing people. And then when their rescue workers coming, you're killing them. And that to me is actually, it's honestly one of the, I don't know where to land on this because there's so many, but it is one of the, it's among the most disgusting things that Israel does. And, you know, watching them kill rescue workers and not even afraid to be doing that and not feel embarrassed to be doing that because they won't face any consequences. And that was, there was that other journalist from Al Jazeera who was forced to bleed to death, like over the course of a few hours
because they just,
yeah. And we don't like, no one knows that name. No one knows what you're talking about, except for people who follow this really closely. Like imagine if Russia had done that. Imagine if Russia had shot a Ukrainian journalist, and then as aid workers and ambulances tried to get to that Ukrainian journalist to save that journalist's life, they killed the rescuers, and that journalist was bleeding out over the course of a few hours. I mean, it would be nonstop coverage and rightfully nonstop coverage and rightfully nonstop condemnation. And we actually have these headlines referring to this like the stenography that you just referred to. So, and this is the great Assal Rad gathered this. She tweeted, "I can't believe these are real headlines. Israel bombed a hospital twice, killing journalists and rescue workers on video for everyone to see. And Western media tries to justify it by saying they were targeting a Hamas camera. This is not journalism. It's embarrassing." And then you see, let's just click through some of them. So the AP, Israeli military says strikes on Gaza hospital targeted what it says was a Hamas camera. Reuters, initial inquiry says Hamas camera was targeted of Israeli strike that killed journalists. Next, CNN, IDF's initial inquiry into Gaza hospital strike claims troops identified Hamas camera. Okay. And then Sky News, Gaza latest, Israel claims troops saw Hamas camera before deadly hospital attack. And again, just imagine if this was a Russian thing, imagine any comparable headlines, right?
Like Putin says, I share your outrage, yeah. And I wish everyone was as outraged. Can we also just take a step back and acknowledge the fact that the first journalist killed in that strike was a Reuters journalist? He was working for them. And helping to cover up the killing of their own journalist. Maryam Abu Daqqa, 33 years old, was working for the Associated Press. The Associated Press minimizes her role with them by calling her a freelancer, doesn't even put her name in a headline. I mean, to your point, everybody should know these names. But part of dehumanization is to gloss over these atrocities, is to minimize them, is to whitewash them, is to help Israel justify and rationalize them. And the fact that we know so little about all of these journalists who were killed, they were somebody's entire universe. Anas al-Sharif was only 28 years old. He had so many opportunities to leave Gaza. In fact, his own family, after he was killed, said that he was told a few days before he was killed, we can help you leave Gaza, just stop reporting. And he refused. That is heroic. That is the pinnacle of what you would consider a journalist of integrity, of professional commitment, of courage and bravery. Maryam Abu Daqqa had been separated from her 12-year-old son for a year and a half before she was killed. All of these journalists have written wills to their loved ones, to their colleagues, last statements and last words. The fact that all of them have taken the time to actually write their last will and testament, the words that they wish to be remembered by, tells you everything about this killing campaign that Israel has unleashed on the journalists of Gaza.
There are like really no words for it. And I'm going to ask you about Western media in one second, but actually I would want to show one more video just because it reveals, again, this deep hatred and the unilateral support given to the government as it slaughters Palestinians and people throughout the region shows, you know, that the West is totally fine with this. And so I want to play a video of U.S. Special Envoy for Syria and Ambassador Turkey Tom Barak, appointed by the Trump administration. And this is from a press conference on Tuesday. And let's hear what he has to say about Lebanese journalists.
Hello. Okay, wait. We're going to have a different set of rules, right? You want, please be quiet for a moment. And I want to tell you something. The moment that this starts becoming chaotic, like animalistic, we're gone. So you want to know what's happening? Act civilized, act kind, act tolerant, because this is the problem with what's happening in the region.
Oh, that's the problem. The problem is what's happening in the region. The Western is not Western-supported genocide. It is what? Animalistic behavior from
disgusting,
journalists?
Racist, dehumanizing, offensive. I mean, to go to their country and talk to them in that really condescending, insulting way. I mean, the bar has definitely shifted the last 2 years when you're seeing a systematic sniping of children in the head and chest. And that's just waved away as collateral damage or whatever it is. When you're seeing the forced starvation of 2 million people, and that's also waved away and explained. I mean, this racist, offensive, dehumanizing, degrading way of speaking to people is the result of those policies. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it kind of says it all.
It's so disgusting. It's just the lack of awareness, or maybe it is awareness, but the sense of impunity. I mean, this person who's working for an administration that is, talk about, I mean, I don't want to offend animals by calling it animalistic. They are the animals. I mean, they are the bad people, right? The bad creatures are Trump and Netanyahu. Like, and he dares to talk to journalists this way. And he would never say that to journalists who weren't from that region. I mean, it's such gaslighting. Like, really, why this is like journalists like you who are animalistic are why we can't have nice things like peace in the Middle East, like the Abraham Accords, right? I mean, that's his inherent disgusting, condescending message. I mean, it's just absolutely revolting. And I actually wanted to show, Brad, let me know when you have those, but we have photos of some of the intrepid journalists who were killed. And I do want to show their images because I think that's important. And while we do that, is there anything that you'd like to share about any of your colleagues who have been killed anything, you know, stories, their names, their any interactions you've had with them that you just want to put on record?
I just want to say that these are the most incredible, devoted, caring, generous people that you can imagine. They're all they want to do is bear witness and tell the story and continue the coverage, because to them, it's a mission that's intrinsic to who they are, regardless of the sacrifice. They're doing all of this. They're covering everything happening in Gaza while suffering the same thing. They've been displaced from their homes so many times, having to sleep in tents. They've been starved. They've been injured. They've lost loved ones, separated from their family members. They have no offices, no equipment. And we're not talking about a few months. This has been going on for almost 2 years. And, you know, their professionalism has been sort of impugned or questioned, whether they're actually journalists. And in fact, in my experience, they're so much more professional than some of the journalism that you see in these legacy newspapers that actually turns out to have been completely debunked. And I'm thinking specifically of some of the October 7th atrocity propaganda that helped lead us to this moment. And just to give you one small example, and we were working on the night won't end, I was in touch with a journalist in Gaza who thankfully is still alive. I very much, you know, pray for his safety, because nobody is safe. This journalist has said, we feel that these are our last days. And the fact that they could just say that says so much. But we were talking about covering a case of a field execution, because we'd heard that Israeli soldiers were actually going into Palestinian homes in Gaza, separating the men from the women and children, and then executing the men in front of the women and children, or sometimes executing the women, depending on the different cases. And he had heard about a case and went to go cover it. But we asked him about who the eyewitnesses were. And he said, well, there was one neighbor who heard but didn't see anything, so I didn't interview him. Imagine if these in these legacy media, legacy newsrooms, if they had that level of professionalism in terms of what actually counts for serious journalism in pursuit of the truth and facts, and not just regurgitating propaganda given to you by a state that's accused of genocide.
Yeah, it's a, it'd be a different world, right? Totally different world. So let's take a look at these murder journalists. So these are the different journalists. Can you see their names, Layla, in this? Is that big enough for you? Do you want to read them? Because your pronunciation will be much better than mine.
Hossam al-Masri was the Reuters journalist who was the first person killed. Maryam Abu Daqqa is the journalist I mentioned, who's 33 years old, who left behind a 12-year-old son. She worked for the Associated Press. Muaz Abu Taha was a freelance journalist who worked with several news organizations. And this is really important. Just days before he was killed, worked on an incredible piece that 972 magazine did about starvation in Gaza, which makes you think this is not accidental. These people are targeted. Mohammed Salama was my colleague at Al Jazeera, incredible journalist. He refused to leave Nasser Hospital complex. He stayed there until the end, and he documented so many atrocities there. And when they kill these journalists, they not only kill the eyes and ears, and they not only stop the coverage, which I think is the intention, they also kill the memory, because these journalists should have been present and war crimes investigations to testify. They were eyewitnesses to crimes that they themselves reported and authentic and documented, and now they're gone. And I think that's part of the intention here in silencing them, is silencing eyewitnesses. And Ahmed Abu Aziz was the last journalist.
So awful. Are there any final words you want to share? Because I'm so appreciative of your time. You're so busy. I would love to know what you're working on now. Also, if there are any particular journalists you want to call out for being particularly egregious on covering this?
Thank you. I mean, I guess I should mention one of the most shameful pieces that I can recall was published actually pretty early on in the genocide, just a couple of weeks after October 7th. It was shortly after the murder of Wa'il al-Dahdouh, my Al Jazeera colleague who was in Gaza at the time, of his wife and two children in their home. It was a very clearly targeted strike. And I'll never forget wet and reporting and hearing, being informed about the killing of his family on air. His emotional reaction, which is a reaction of anybody having heard that their own family was murdered, preying on their bodies and then putting on his vest once again and continuing the coverage right away. It was just such an inspiring, heroic, courageous act, so resilient. And the New Yorker publishes a piece not long, just days after. I mean, their blood hadn't yet dried of these family members who'd been killed, demonizing Palestinian journalists as Hamas propagandists simply for covering the genocide of their people. It was one of the most shameful pieces in the entire genocide. And that's saying a lot. I mean, articles like that continue to put a target on the backs of journalists. I will never forget that. And one of the co-authors of that piece went on to get a job at the New York Times as his prize. Of course, all of these institutions have had a role in, you know, we've already covered this and kind of repeating the propaganda and helping justify these murders. But I would just say, please continue supporting these journalists, sharing their work, giving them words of support. It really means a lot to them. A lot of them are very active on social media, and it really means a lot to them to hear people decrying these murders, but also giving them words of support and sharing their work.
That is such a good message to end on. But unfortunately, I have to ask you about one more thing, and then I will give you the mic again, because I don't want to end on these notes of infuriating things. But okay, this is an interview published. I don't know if you saw this, but there was an interview published, and I got this from Sana Saeed, her Twitter account. So the Biden administration, in an interview published by The New Yorker Tuesday, with Jacob L. Liu, who was a former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Biden and a former Obama official and is a current professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University. He made some really interesting remarks. So let's read. This is an interview with Isaac Chotiner. And so Isaac Chotiner says, when you call them in the middle of the night and say, what on earth happened? What was usually the answer? The general pattern was that the in-the-moment stories were inaccurate and that the Israeli military and government establishment were not in a position to fully explain yet. We could almost never get answers that explain what happened before the story was fully framed in international media. And then when the facts were fully developed, it turned out that the casualties were much lower, the numbers of civilians was much lower, and in many cases, the children were children of Hamas fighters, not children taking cover in places. And Chotiner says, sorry, what did you just say? He goes, in many cases, the original members of casualties. No, I mean the thing about who the children were. They were often the children of fighters themselves. And therefore, what follows from that? What follows is that whether or not it was a legitimate military target flows from the population that's there. Okay, so you have a Biden official, current Columbia University professor, saying that it's a legitimate target to assassinate children whose parents are allegedly, and who even knows, but let's say that they were. That does not actually follow international humanitarian law.
It's disgusting. It's not that surprising because this is how genocide happens, is you have policies that deem every single civilian a legitimate target, including a child. And you say, that's a legitimate target, go crazy. And that's how genocide happens. Jack Liu, Biden's ambassador to Israel, was also instrumental in the starvation policy. He and Antony Blinken both were instrumental in the policy to starve Gaza, to put pressure on Hamas. So this is a person who believes it's legitimate to starve an entire population, and it's legitimate to kill children, depending on who their parents are. Now, that's not what international law says. It's not what any norms and values say. So how can you say that you're any better than the Trump administration or any better than any other country that you accuse of human rights violations? There's an absolute void of morality here, of values. And I think that's why this genocide has been such a massive turning point for people in terms of the mask falling off and a complete disillusionment with the West and with what supposed like Western values of human rights, of equality, of justice, of, you know, distinguishing between people who are combatants and people who are civilians. If you allow all of these atrocities to happen in Gaza with zero guardrails, zero accountability, zero rules of engagement, and the gloves are just off and you can murder everyone, you can justify everything, then did these values ever exist to begin with? Or were they simply a cudgel that you used to take down other countries, to accuse other countries of doing what you're doing magnitudes more?
Yeah, just awful, despicable, and saying it out loud again. Well, let's play this, the wild video, because I think it's so upsetting, but it's also in some ways, it's just so inspiring. I don't know if it's possible to say that, because it's hard to even use those words in the same sentence, because this is a man whose family was murdered. But it's just a testament, I guess, to his strength and fortitude. And what is that? The word, the Samud word that's like,
resilience.
Which is what? Steadfastness.
But you can see kind of the shock still in his eyes. And most likely, Samir, the journalist that you mentioned who bled out to death, was the one behind the camera, because he was his longtime cameraman. Wael was with him and injured when Samir was attacked. And I should mention, in that attack, they had informed the Israeli military of their coordinates. The Israeli military had cleared them to go cover the aftermath of an attack, only to target and attack them. So it just shows you the viciousness of how they're operating.
Well, thank you, Leila. I really wish more journalists had your integrity, and maybe someone like Barry Weiss could study you for like millions of years. She wouldn't be able to. I mean, she should be in The Hague anyway. But no, really, thank you so much. Anything else that you want to mention that you're working on?
Thank you so much, Katie. We're working on an episode about the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And some of the cases of Palestinians who were murdered while being starved and trying to get food. And in a few weeks, we're also releasing an episode about Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya.
Yeah, what is his status right
now? His status is he's in detention currently in horrific conditions. You know, he's experienced horrific conditions from the moment of his detention, not to mention, of course, all the attacks on the hospital as well, Kamal Adwan Hospital, as well as, of course, the killing of one of his sons. His other son was injured. He himself was attacked and injured. So he's still in detention. He was, I believe, labeled as an unlawful combatant under Israel's new unlawful combatant law, which they passed after October 7th, and which they're using very freely, again, under horrific conditions. And it's basically a kangaroo court. Like, there's no real system. There's no real accusations. He's obviously a doctor who worked under the most, you know, difficult conditions imaginable and never left. And that was his crime, that he never left.
Right. And he had the chance because his wife is from another country.
Correct.
And he, of course, is this very brave doctor who never left, whose son was killed. And there's that incredible shot of him walking through bombed out ruins. And he goes towards a tank. And there's footage of him getting in the tank, and he hasn't been released since. And again, it's just like this war on doctors. Again, something that you would think that doctors around the world would be up in arms about.
I think about what your other guest, Dean, said earlier. I'm on Team Israel. And when people are on Team Israel, somehow their morals and values and cognitive function seems to just stop. And they're any, you know, sort of compassion and feeling for other human beings seems to be devoid of that. And you can justify everything under the sun, everything that's unjustifiable.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's true. It's a disease. It's a brain disease, honestly. Well, thank you, Leila, so much. Really. Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
Have a great night. So that was the absolutely amazing Leila Al-Aryan, and her work is so wonderful, and everyone should also follow her on Twitter, but her journalism is just great. Her documentaries are amazing, and really grateful to people like Leila. And this is one of her great films, The Night Won't End, which is heartbreaking but worth watching. And thank you all for coming to this show tonight. Also want to encourage people, this is this was a very much heavier, obviously, discussion. If you want something lighter, but also substantive, because we do get into the Laura Loomer stuff and we also get into Heal Palestine. The very hilarious Blakely and I had a chat like over an hour long where we talk about Laura Loomer. We talk about paid influencers for Israel. We talk about Destiny, you know, that weird guy, that fabulous idiot or whatever Norman called him, Mr. Borelli, Mr. Bazzelli. That's at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And please do subscribe if you haven't already. Please do like this stream and we will see you next week. Anything else I need to remind people of, Brad? Thank you, Brad, for being the Wizard of Oz. Thank you, Nate, for the research. Thank you, Fantomus Fanta, for the clips that we put out during the stream. And I will see you all next week.